Well, good morning, Fellowship Bible. How's everyone doing today? You braved the rain. Good job. Made it to church on Sunday. Well done. Well, you may recall, Pastor Lloyd is on sabbatical for about a six-week timeline. And there's a handful of us that are covering his absence as pinch hitters, so to speak, myself included. So I'm honored to be with you this morning and to be opening up God's Word together. If we've never met before, or if you had a really good long summer vacation and missed July, my name is Mike. Mike Vogt. I'm a member here at Fellowship. I've been here for 20-ish years, and I am honored to be able to serve the church in the capacity of elder here at Fellowship Bible as well. I hope you've been enjoying the Gospel of John. I hope you've really been enjoying our series as we've been going through this book together. Full transparency, when I first got to Fellowship, I thought it was kind of weird that this church would take up to a year to go through a book of the Bible from the pulpit. I became a Christian at 21 in Western Canada, and the church that I went to didn't approach Sunday mornings the way that we do in an expository fashion. And I truly thought it was strange that we would literally take a year to go through a book of the Bible. But I've got to tell you that I absolutely love it, and I think it's one of the reasons why I am still here at Fellowship, and this is very much my church home. I love that we take our time going through a book of the Bible. The teacher can't just skip around to their favorite passages in the book. They can't bypass the hard stuff. We go methodically verse by verse by verse all the way through a book of the Bible, and I just love our approach to that. We are going to be going back to John chapter 4 today, and I hope in our time together in the book of John, you've enjoyed it, and I hope that you found some of the ways that John's gospel is a little bit different from the other gospels we find in our New Testament. John has a lot of standalone content, so to speak. He's different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You've probably heard the term before that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptic gospels. That's a word you'll hear thrown around sometimes from the pulpit. What does synoptic mean? Well, think of the word optic, right? It means view. And syn, S-Y-N, it means the same. So the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all have a similar view. They all share a same view in their content. And what you'll find as you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's a lot of parallel content between them because they share the same view, and they all seem to be trying to communicate the details of the life of Christ. John's gospel, however, is a little bit different. John has got a lot of very distinctive content that you won't find anywhere else in the gospels. In fact, I'll just put on the screen here for a second here. John actually tells you what he's aiming for in writing his gospel. He says near the end of his gospel in John chapter 20, verse 31, he says, "These things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." What's John trying to do in his gospel? He's trying to make you worship, and he's trying to make you believe. John's gospel is trying to compel belief in Jesus Christ. And if you look at this through kind of a literary perspective, if you're looking at this through the lens of what's John's approach to this goal, well, what John does in his gospel is he introduces us to monumental people, encounters that Jesus has with just epic individuals, and that's the way that John compels us to believe. The first one of these introductions, the first one of these stories is the story of Nicodemus. We came across this in John chapter 2. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but you won't read about Nicodemus in any of the other gospels. It's only in John. After that, you advance a couple chapters to where we were about 2 weeks ago, and we read the story or the encounter of Jesus and the woman at the well. Just an incredible encounter of this woman who's pulling water from a well around midday. Why is she there in the middle of the day when no one else is there and it's crazy hot? Well, it's because she doesn't want to encounter anybody. She's carrying a lot of shame in her story. She has a lot of things in her life that she's not proud of, and so she goes when hopefully no one else will be drawing water, and Jesus meets her there. That's the story of the woman at the well, and of course, we'll see in our text in a bit how that turned out. Advance a little bit to John chapter 8, and you find one of my favorite stories in all of the New Testament. And that's the story of Jesus who encounters a woman who was caught in the act of adultery. Just an incredible, incredible exchange between Jesus, this woman, and the people who were there to judge her. I love that. And then you fast forward to John chapter 11, and you see Jesus and the story of Lazarus, the incredible story of the raising of Lazarus from the grave. Now, you might say, oh, I'm very familiar with Lazarus. I know the story of the woman in adultery, the woman at the well. Please realize these are epic, epic stories, but they are found nowhere else in your New Testament. They are exclusive to the Gospel of John. What we're going to find in our story this morning is that we're going to see that Jesus is going to have an encounter with another individual. And the guy we're going to look at today, he probably gets less preaching than some of the other people that are found in the Gospel of John in terms of Jesus' encounters with individuals. But the person we're going to see today, you're going to like him because he's a whole lot like us. And God is going to get his attention. You see, the man in our story today, he's a great picture of the development of faith. Our guy in the text this morning, he starts off kind of deistic, right? He's got kind of a general belief in a distant God. And then he's going to move from there to believing in Jesus Christ. He's going to choose to trust Jesus. And then he's going to move from there to become an evangelist within his household. And this is all going to happen in a span of about 10 or 12 verses. Now, what's interesting in our story this morning, and I want you to cue into this, God's going to use a hardship in this guy's life. And he's going to use this hardship to get this guy's attention. Now, throughout the Gospels, you see Jesus encounter down and outers all the time. You see Jesus encounter the destitute, the lowly, the poor, the leper, and so forth. Today's encounter is a little bit different. Jesus is going to have an encounter with a very wealthy individual. And Jesus is going to have to get this guy's attention. And the way he does that is by a suffering or a hardship in this gentleman's life. Suffering will be the means by which this guy is going to discover his great need for God. Now, many people in the room, they feel that our hardships and they feel like the suffering that we experience in this world, they feel like these experiences are somehow at odds. They somehow don't square with the idea of a God that loves us and is all powerful and is all good. Some people would call this the problem of evil or the problem of suffering. And it goes something like this. If God is all good, surely he would want us to experience joy, not suffering. And if God was all powerful, surely he could eradicate suffering, but yet we still experience suffering in this world. In fact, one person says it better than the rest. I love quoting C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis says, if God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy. And if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished. But the creatures are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. This is the problem of pain in its simplest form. There might be some people in the room this morning who are wondering, God, why would you allow suffering in my life? Why would you allow pain and hardship in my life? Some of you might be walking a very personal road this morning, experiencing a hardship that just has you feeling like you're in the crosshairs. And it's been a tough journey for you. Well, God, why do you allow us to suffer? Why do you allow us to experience pain? In part, I want to try to answer that question by asking you a question. What does your salvation story look like? What does your journey to God look like when you examine your own story, your own past? See, if I'm gonna guess what your salvation story looks like, I'm gonna hypothesize that your journey to God didn't look something like, well, I woke up one morning and I pondered the holiness of God and I earnestly sought his justification. It, probably your journey to God didn't look very intellectual and very abstract like that. No, your pilgrim's progress probably started with something a whole lot more desperate. Maybe you were suffering or straining or reeling from a broken relationship. Maybe you felt like you were just over the barrel because of a broken marriage. Some of you may have felt like you were at the end of your rope because of financial distress. And some of you may have felt like you were calling out to God for the first time because of a health tragedy. Guys, I will tell you that a cancer diagnosis has probably led more people to faith in Christ than the single most effective evangelist on the earth. Why? It's because it's in our hardships and it's in our suffering that we call out to God. And for the highly capable, for the highly successful people, I'm talking Williamson County type people, sometimes for us, our self-sufficiency needs to be stripped away. Our independence, our ill-perceived independence needs to be pulled back in order for us to be able to see clearly our need for God. So that's actually going to be point one in my sermon this morning, even though we haven't gotten to our text yet. We'll go ahead and put point one up on the screen. That's this: life-giving faith is often born out of suffering. If you're using your John booklet, I think there's a little bit of real estate on that page to the right of our text this morning. Go ahead and write that down. Point one: life-giving faith is often born out of suffering. I will tell you that this is certainly true in my salvation story. We're going to find out in just a little bit it was true in the story of the nobleman, of the royal official who came to Jesus with a need. And I suspect for some of you in the room this morning, it was true for you as well. I'm going to guess you didn't come to Jesus because of convenience or something that was simple. You probably came to Jesus out of some form of desperation. So let's get to our text today, shall we? Our text this morning is coming on the heels of Jesus who was down in Jerusalem. He was at the Passover feast, and Jesus is going home. He's heading back up to Galilee. And whereas most Jews going back to Galilee would go around Samaria, right? The Samaritans and the Jews are no great friends historically. Whereas most people would go around Samaria, Jesus chooses to go through Samaria to go home. This is where he encounters the woman at the well that we found in the early part of John chapter 4. And this woman and Jesus have this really interesting exchange, and Jesus reveals to her that he is the source of living water. And if you drink of me, you will never thirst again. And he reveals to her that he's the Messiah of Israel. And then this woman goes back to her village, the town of Sychar, and she shares this encounter with everybody that she can tell. And we read in John chapter 4, verse 42, the people say to the woman, the people in the village say to the woman, "It is no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and we now know that this is indeed the Savior of the world." That's the verse that we land on before we get to this morning's text. So Jesus has had a couple of days of incredibly fruitful ministry in Samaria, and now he's going to complete his journey home. He's heading back to Galilee, but this pit stop in Samaria was incredibly productive. All right, let's pick up our text for today. If we look at our text where we pick up right from where we left off last week, we're in John 4:43, and it says this: "After 2 days, he departed for Galilee. For Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too were at the feast." Now, at first glance, this is kind of a perplexing couple of verses. Jesus was in Samaria, where he was received with gladness, and now he's heading home. He's going back to his old stomping grounds, Galilee, and he kind of warns the disciples. He says, "Guys, a prophet has no honor in his hometown, and I'm going home." Translation, he's kind of saying to his disciples, "Gents, this isn't going to go as well as it went in Samaria." He's kind of warning them that this is not going to be great. And yet, when he gets to Galilee, what happens? They welcome him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem. Well, how can a warning that the home team prophet will not be honored in his own hometown be followed up immediately by a grand welcome? Well, the answer to that, church, is that the welcome reception isn't exactly what it seems on the outside. And John actually gives us a cue of this in his description. Look at the verse closely. "They welcomed him, ... because they, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast." Why did they welcome him? They saw what he did at Passover. They saw him doing some cool stuff. They liked his miracles. You guys, Jesus wants to be accepted not because of his preaching Jesus wants to be accepted because of his preaching, not because of his power. He wants to be received because of the truth that he brought and the discovery of who he is, not because of the perks that he can bring. And what's interesting when you read the miracle accounts of Jesus in the New Testament, sometimes you'll see him say something to the people that he heals, which is kind of a head scratcher. He will say to them after he heals them, "Go and tell no one." Why does he tell them to be tight-lipped about the healing that he just provided for them? Because he doesn't want his power to detract from his message. He wants to be discovered as the Messiah of Israel, doesn't want to be someone that can just simply perform the miraculous. So when it says that the Galileans received him, having seen his miracles, you need to realize this is not a good thing. These are people who want to be entertained. All right, let's move on in our text. Verse 46 says this, "So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water into wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. And when this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death." So here John's introducing a new character into the story. We have an official. Other translations, if you're looking at something other than the ESV, they describe this man as a royal official. John doesn't give us a whole lot of detail about this guy, but let me tell you what we know about him. As a royal official, this man would have been a Jew who had somehow attached himself to the Roman government in Galilee. What does that mean? That means that in some capacity, this guy works for Herod, all right? And it's safe to assume that as a royal official, this man's life would have been fairly comfortable. This guy would resemble to his peers, this guy would have resembled worldly success. This guy is Williamson County, all right? This guy has made it. This guy has arrived. Now, at the church I first attended when I became a believer in Western Canada, there was a guy that stood up one night on a testimony night, and he had said something to the effect of, "I had never sought out God. I had never felt or perceived a need for God. I had never thought of coming to the Lord." He said, "But I had a drug problem." He said, "My mom drugged me to church. And then she drugged me to Bible study. And then she drugged me to vacation Bible school." Well, there may be some of you in the room this morning that are only here because somebody drugged you. And you too have a drug problem. Perhaps there's no sense of God in your life because you've made it, because you are successful, and you're only here because the person next to you drug you. And if that's the case, give them a very discreet elbow to let them know you're thinking about them in this moment. See, if that's you, and you're experiencing worldly success, you might be thinking to yourself, "Hey, I think that Jesus deal is great, and I think a lot of you need him, but not me. You see, I've got X, fill in the blank. I've got my business, so I don't need God. Thank you very much. Or I've got my inherited family wealth, so I don't need God. Thank you very much. Or I've got my athletic ability. Or I've got my musical talent. I'm good. Thank you." The guy in our story this morning, his answer to that would be, "I've got Herod, so I'm good. Thank you very much." Yeah, this guy this morning is a Jew, but he's a nominal Jew at best. If we bring this to a modern context, this is a guy that would show up to church on Christmas and Easter, and that's about it. But what we're going to find is that God is going to get this guy's attention. And it's not going to be by preaching, it's going to be by disease. You see, being a person of significant status does not exempt this guy from experiencing the tragedies of ordinary life. And God's going to hit this guy where it hurts. So what does a royal official do? Well, he makes a trip from Capernaum, which is right on the edges of the Sea of Galilee, and he travels roughly 20 miles to Cana. Why does he go there? Because he hears that Jesus is in Cana. And this is going to get to point number two. We'll go ahead and put this back up on the screen. Point number two that I want to have you put on the right-hand side of your notes is this: life-giving faith begins with reason. Life-giving faith begins with reason. Why does the royal official make the trip to Cana? Well, it's because he has heard stories. He has heard reports. I don't know if this guy was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast and saw Jesus do miracles. Maybe he has friends or family that were at the Passover and saw him perform miracles. Maybe this guy had friends that were at the wedding at Cana, where Jesus turned the water into wine. Again, that was only 20 miles from here. Maybe that's why he's choosing to go to Jesus. We don't know, but the guy makes the trip. Why? Because he thinks there's a reasonable case to be made that if I go see Jesus, maybe there's something he can do for my kid. And selfishly, this guy is saying, I need Jesus to come through because my son is knocking on death's door. Any self-sufficiency this guy had perceived previously, any independence, which is so likely among the wildly successful, it's now gone. This father is desperate because he knows his son doesn't have much time or perhaps much hope. And if you're a parent in this room this morning, I suspect you know how this feels. There's just about anything I would do for my kid if they were in the same circumstance. So note the guy's request. I'll go back a slide here. Note the guy's request. Jesus, he went from Judea to Galilee, and he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son. He asks Jesus to come down and heal his son. He's saying, will you return with me to Capernaum so that my son can be healed? He begs Jesus to come with him. But now watch Jesus' response. This is where it gets interesting. Jesus says to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. Several other translations I looked at said, unless you people see signs and wonders, making it not just the royal official, but the Galileans in general. Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And then the official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. A couple of observations here. This is probably not the sort of response that this royal official is used to hearing. In fact, if people were gathered here that were familiar with this royal official, they were probably shocked at the words that they heard Jesus speak in this moment. Nobody would dare address a high-ranking official with a tone like this. But Jesus is not exactly courting human approval, is he? When I first read this part of the text, it kind of jarred me. It seemed snarky. It seemed kind of nasty. Here's a desperate father going to Jesus, and he kind of wags a finger at them. You people. And it felt displaced. Right? Jesus' criticism, it's clearly intended for the Galileans as a whole, not just for this father, but his tone, it caught me off guard. And there's a few places in the Gospels where we see people come to Jesus with fairly straightforward requests, and he kind of comes back with what feels like a tone. In fact, his last trip to Cana, you might recall he's at this wedding feast, and Mary leans over to Jesus and says, they're out of wine. You remember Jesus' response? Woman, why do you involve me? My hour has not yet come. Excuse me? That's your mother. I think if I spoke to my mother like that, she would have flicked my mouth, right? Why do you involve me? Guys, when people come to Jesus with very simple, very straightforward requests, and he kind of rebukes them, even when their requests are desperate, you need to realize that there's only ever one reason for Jesus' choice of words. And it's the same every time. It's love. Jesus is choosing his words because it's necessary, and it's always driven by the emotion of love. Here's what you need to realize this morning in John chapter 4. The man in this story has no idea who Jesus is. He has no idea who Jesus is. Now, there's a similar story to this one in Matthew chapter 8. There's a story of a centurion, a German soldier, who comes to Jesus and says, I have a servant at home who's gravely ill, who needs to be healed. What does Jesus say to the centurion? Let's go home. Let's go back to your place and I'll heal him. Remember what the centurion says in Matthew 8? No, I am not worthy to have you under my roof. You see, the centurion has some concept of who Jesus is, but our guy this morning doesn't. There's no indication here of any deference, of any kind of trust. There's no recognition this morning in our story of who Jesus is. This guy thinks that Jesus is some worker of wonders, right? Perhaps he thinks that he's like a magician or a sorcerer like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. Or perhaps he thinks that Jesus is like a genie and all he needs to figure out how to do is, man, if I can just somehow figure out how to rub this thing just right, maybe I rub this side, how do I do this? If I can just rub this thing just right, I can somehow unlock the power or the magic that is inside this Jesus character. The Father's looking for the magic. And what we find in our story this morning is that Jesus is deliberately trying to make it hard for this guy. The royal official wants an immediate response, but Jesus puts off the response. Why? Because Jesus doesn't just want to heal the boy physically. He wants to heal the whole family spiritually. But that's going to take this man looking beyond the magic to seeing who Jesus really is. So what's Jesus doing with his response? He's trying to draw the man out. He's trying to tap into the man's desperation to bring him to a different place. And that's why Jesus challenges the man twice. The first one is a put-off. Unless you see signs and wonders, right? Jesus is saying to the man, you're after the supernatural. You're after my power. You're not after me. But then after the first rebuke, you see on the screen here the second choice of words from the Father. Sir, come down before my child dies. If you read this in the Greek, the word choice for the child is different. In the first choice, the royal official says, my son. On here, it says, my child. But if you read the Greek, the word choice is more like, come down before my little one dies. It's more tender. It's more desperate. And when he says, sir, come down, I envision the Father on his knees. This Father is dialing up the desperation to Jesus, and he's saying, Jesus, you are my only shot. I'm asking you to come through for me. He's sort of like Jacob in the Old Testament, wrestling with God. And he's saying, I will not let you go until you bless me. So what does Jesus say to this man? Let's go to the next verse, verse 50. It says this, Jesus said to him, go, your son will live. Let's start with that for beginning. Remember, the man asks Jesus to go with him to Capernaum. What does Jesus say? I'm not going with you. Now, he could have done that. He could have said, hey, let's go together. Let's make the trek. The way that he offered to go home with the centurion, but he doesn't offer to do that. Now, I have to assume that if you're the father, this is a terrible response. Why? Folks, throughout the history of Israel, if you wanted what a prophet had to offer, the prophet had to be present. If you look at the miracles that were performed by Moses or by Elijah or by Elisha, every time you saw them perform miracles, they were physically present, laying the staff on the man's face and so on and so forth. But here Jesus is making a claim that must have been simply astounding to his hearers. I can heal your son with a word. Nobody in redemptive history has ever been able to heal with simply a word, at least not until now. Do you realize how godlike that is? That's incredible. For Jesus, his word and his deed are the same thing. Go, your son will live. It's sort of like saying, let there be light. And there was light. Incredible. And so what does the father do with this statement? It's on your screen. The rest of verse 50 says that the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. Another translation says the man took Jesus at his word and departed. That's point number 3. Life-giving faith must move from reason to personal trust. You see, in this encounter, Jesus has moved this man from a rational belief in his power to a personal trust in who he is. The royal official is no longer seeing a miracle worker, he's seeing the Messiah. He's not believing about Jesus, he's believing Jesus. And he's gone from intellectual assent to a faith that is now entrusting his life. What I like about this encounter is that, do you remember what Jesus' criticism was of the Galileans at the start of this passage? You Galileans will not what? you will not believe unless you see signs and wonders. What happens here? Does the man leave having seen a sign? Nope, he doesn't see a sign. The man leaves believing Jesus, having never seen a sign. And guys, this sort of faith, it's found in several places in the New Testament, and every single time we find it, it is explicitly praised by Jesus. Why? Because most of us will never see a miracle. Most of us will never behold the power of God with our own eyes. It'll not be part of our experience. We'll never see it with our own experience, and yet we are asked to believe. And that's why Jesus praises people who believe without even having seen. In fact, at the end of the Gospel of John, there's an exchange between Jesus and his disciples in his resurrected state. Thomas is there, and Thomas hears the word that Jesus has risen. He's like, I'm not going to believe it until I can see the dude. Jesus shows up and says, Thomas, put your finger right here. And all of a sudden, Thomas believes and says, my Lord and my God. And Jesus says this, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So let me ask you a question. If you're the father in the story right now, how are you feeling? You've left Jesus in Cana. You've started the long journey home. And he's told you that your son will live, but he ain't coming with you. How are you feeling if you're the father in this story right now? Are you like, woo, my boy's healed, yeah. Or are you like, oh man, I hope this worked. I hope Jesus could do what he said he can do. Which one are you? I'm sure there's some gap between the two of those positions, but I have to feel like the father is more like the second than the first. If I'm the father, that's how I'm feeling. Why? Because the stakes are high. If Jesus can't do what he said he can do, I know I'm going home to a funeral. And so this desperate father is hoping that this Jesus actually is who he says he is and that he can do what he says he can do. There's several stories of desperate fathers in the New Testament. And this story echoes a little bit to me. As I was reading this, the story echoed a little bit to me of the father that we read about in Mark chapter 9. This is the encounter between Jesus and a boy who's been demon-possessed. And a father brings the boy to Jesus, and Jesus says, how long has he been like this? The father says, ever since he was a child. Jesus says, what's going on? The father says, the demon causes my son to sometimes froth out at the mouth and sometimes to convulse, and it even throws him into the fire sometimes. And the father looks at Jesus and he says these words, Jesus, if you can do anything, please take pity on us and help us. And Jesus looks back at the father and says, if you can? Jesus says, anything is possible for one who believes. And I love the father's response after that. He says, I do believe. Please help me in my unbelief. The father is clinging by his fingernails to faith, but he has this first germination, this first seedling of faith and of trusting Christ. The father in Mark 9 is not dissimilar from the father in John 4. Their faith is very fragile. And there will never be a psalm that'll be written about the prayer or the faith of these men. But what you'll find is that that seedling of faith is enough to move Jesus into action. And so that brings me to my next point. Point number four is this. Life-giving faith saves by its object, not by its quality. What do I mean by that? Guys, it's not the quality of your faith. It's not the strength of your faith that makes a difference. Thankfully, right? It's the object of your faith, Jesus Christ. You may be clinging by your fingernails to faith, but shrouded in fears and doubts and uncertainty because of the circumstances that life is throwing at you. But what we learn from the story and from others in the New Testament is this: how much faith do you need? Well, if you're the royal official in our story this morning, you just need enough faith to go home. You see, it wasn't this man's faith that saved his son. It was Jesus that saved his son. But it was this man's seedling faith that tapped into Jesus' power, and Jesus' power saved his son. How much faith do you have to have, and how much faith do I have to have? Just enough to do what Jesus said. Now, how does this story wind up? Let's go forward in our text. Verse 51 says this. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him. Then the father knew that that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And I love this verse. And he himself believed, and his whole household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. He himself believed, and his whole household. That brings us to our fifth point, which is this. Life-giving faith matures from trust into conviction. This father's faith started as reason, it started as inquiry, it then moved to a trust in Jesus, and then it matured into conviction. How do we know that? Because this guy shared what Jesus did with his whole household. That's what happens to you, and that's what happens to me when we are convicted about what Jesus has done in our life. We tell others, starting with the people in our lives that we love. We tell our household, and we tell our coworkers, we tell our friends, we tell people who are close to us that mean something to us what Jesus has done for us in our lives. Guys, this man this morning shows us the progression or the development of faith. Now, I'm going to invite the worship band to come out. We're going to wrap up our time together this morning. As I was reading some commentaries on this section of John this morning, I found a sermon from a preacher named Charles Simeon, and he was an English preacher in Great Britain that lived in the 1800s. And it's always kind of fun to read what other people saw in a verse or in a passage. And when I read Charles Simeon's practical application, I thought, you know what? I don't think I can do any better than that this morning. So I'm going to simply quote Charles Simeon as we wrap up our time together this morning. Charles Simeon has 3 points for conclusion. I thought these were great. Number one, when you have a problem, go to Jesus. If you have are you suffering right now? Do you have a problem that you're experiencing in your life? Are you experiencing hardship and pain and uncertainty? Go to Jesus. Number two, let Jesus answer you on his own terms. The man in our story this morning knew exactly how he wanted Jesus to answer him, but Jesus had a different path in mind. He had a different way that he wanted to address the situation, and we've got to trust that Jesus knows better. Why? Because he loves us, and sometimes he accomplishes a greater good by the way he chooses to hear and address our prayers and our pleas for help. Let Jesus answer you on his own terms. And the third point of application is this: tell your whole house about it. Tell your whole house about what Jesus Christ has done in your life.